So at the beginning of December, or actually mid-December for the holidays, I went to Milwaukee. And I'm not a cold weather fan at all. But that's where my co-mother-in-law lives, and my son and his wife were going to spend holidays there, so I went there as well. And came back and did a almost month-long silent retreat. And Tuesday, I'm going to Upper Peninsula, Michigan. And I was going to cancel because this week the high was -2 degrees. Next week the high will be 17 degrees. So my son said, "It's balmy now. You need to come." So Winterfest in Houghton, Michigan. That's where I will be next week. So just ordered this extremely warm coat from Eddie Bauer and spent way more money than I wanted to. I'll probably just leave it there along with boots and thermal stuff. So anyway, just wanted to let you know about my holidays and what's going on. So tonight we're going to be talking about stream entry, a stream enterer. It's called a sotipanna in Pali. And how many of you hope to be enlightened one day? Wow, a lot of you. Excellent.
Maybe not in this lifetime. That's not a joke.
I understand. And how many of you would just like to have less stress in your life? Even more. There are two types of practitioners. And the first is people who actually hope in this lifetime or another lifetime, if you believe in multiple lifetimes, to be completely free from suffering. And the second type of practitioner is someone who wants to alleviate stress in this lifetime. The practice is the same as far as Buddhist practice goes, but the amount you put into it, the dedication you put into it is significantly different. The amount of studying, time spent on retreat, teachers, that kind of thing, it's different. So a stream enterer, or a sotipanna, is the first marker on the path to awakening. And as since we are a Theravadin community and we use the Pali Canon as the basis for our study, the Pali Canon has four categories of markers for waking up. You can go by them completely or not. You know, it's up to you. I think they can be very useful, especially, and I'll go into this, the way they are determined. But I think they can also be very rigid, saying this, 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 and this has to happen. I know from talking to many of you in my own experience, this, this, and this doesn't happen. But you also have insight, and you have times of awakening, which close up again, and times of awakening and close up again. And so they're good milestones in a kind of, for me, a general kind of way of looking at it. So the good thing about, okay, we're going to go back to classic Theravadin teachings. The good thing about sotapanna is lay people can achieve this state. No jhana is necessary. Jhana is the extremely concentrated state of mind that are necessary in the next levels. But for sotipanna, not necessary. I even did a paper on this when I was going through with Gil and going through minister training. I did a paper on can somebody who just practices the five precepts achieve sotipanna? And yes, according to the classical teachings, they can. And interesting, once you achieve sotipanna, there's no going back. You can never go backwards and say, oh, you know what? This is too hard. I'm not going to do it. And I know, because I've talked to a number of you, have said, this is really hard. But now that I know, there's nothing I can do about it. I have to stick with it.
So is it Sotapanna?
It's Sotapanna. Sotapanna. S-O-T-A-P-A-N-N-A. I'll go into more of it in just a minute. So, speaking of jhana, when I was on retreat, and this is a good thing about doing solo retreats, I read. And I read Lee Brazington's book on concentration, which I highly recommend. It's a really, really good book on the jhanas. Also read this book by Sam Harris, Waking Up. And I'm a huge Sam Harris fan. And makes a lot of sense from a guy who's a neuroscientist, a doctorate in neuroscience and philosophy. Let's go back to the markers. So, the 10 fetters, does everybody know what the fetters are? Okay. The fetters are the way of marking how you are doing on this continuum of getting towards awakening. I've given talks on the fetters, and I actually think they are really helpful. So the fetters are, the first one is, and fetter means asava or effluent or something not to cling to, something to move away from. The first fetter is self-identity, how we view ourselves and how we think everybody views us. In fact, my day long is going to be on this subject at the end of this month. The second one is doubt, the fetter of doubt. The third is the fetter of rites and rituals, thinking if I just do it this, this, and this, and this, everything will be okay. The fourth is sensuous desire, being just overruled by sensuous desire. The fifth is aversion. These are the five lower fetters. And these are what the first three steps that I'm going to be talking about, these markers, take care of. The five higher fetters, only arhats, completely enlightened beings, are able to completely get rid of. And the sixth is desiring life. Seventh is not desiring life. The eighth, and I love this one, is conceit. Nice to know that even somebody who's in the higher fetters is worried about something conceitful. The ninth, I think, is even better, restlessness. I mean, wow, is that good to know that, you know, these people who are well on their way, arhats, bodhisattvas, they still are restless. And the final one is ignorance. So completely wise, knowing what to do in every situation. That would be great. So I'm going to very briefly go over these four steps leading to enlightenment. As I just said, stream enter Sotapanna gets rid of the first three fetters that we're going to go into in a little bit. The once returner is called a Sakadami. And that person will only, oh, I forgot, the stream enter will have seven more lifetimes. But those lifetimes will always be at least in the human realm and maybe higher. So you won't be born in an animal realm. You won't be someone's dinner. So it's good. The Sakadagami will be born only one more time, and that will be in a heavenly realm. Non-returner is an Anagami, and will only be born, if at all, in the Deva realm, kind of like angels. And then the Arhat is a fully awakened being. The Buddha and many of his disciples were Arhats. Completely awakened, all 10 fetters had been abandoned. The Arhat is the only one who abandons the five higher fetters. So the we're going to talk about the Sotapanna, which has removed the fetters of self-identity, doubt, and clinging to rites and rituals. All right. And if you are a stream enter, it means you are committed to this path of awakening. This is like the number one priority for you. It informs your life. There's actually no concrete step saying do this, this, and this, because that goes back to rites and rituals. But what you need to do, and Gil Fronsdale just did a course on this, and I don't think Wendy's here. Is she? Wendy took the course. I audited it, and it is called Entering the Stream. And what Gil's course does is he tells you how to set the conditions for a mind state that is open to stream entry. Not easy to do. We'll be going into that in a minute. Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who's a very orthodox Theravadan monk, also has a course on stream entry, but it's much more linear, and here's the list, and here's what you need to do to set the conditions so you will be a stream enter. I think both views are helpful, and I'm actually using more of Thanissaro Bhikkhu's because it's easier to do in a kind of numerical set rather than Gil's course. But Gil's course was really, really wonderful. He gave me permission to teach it, and I might be teaching it here at SIM sometime this year, assuming I get some time to do that. So both courses talked about the conditions that lead to stream entry. What do you have to do? And there's four traditional conditions that have to take place. And the first one is associating with people of integrity. So Thanissaro Bhikkhu breaks it down into teachers and to your friends. So teachers, does that mean you have to find the teacher who is perfect and you figure is an enlightened being? I don't think there's too many around, frankly. But a teacher should be able to, according to both Gil and Thanissaro Bhikkhu, be able to know where they need work and be open about it and be humble about it. They have attenuated greed and hatred. So it's you know, I keep telling people when I speak to them, just be honest. Just be honest. Be honest about yourself, about what's going on. That's what you want to see in a teacher as well. And regarding friends, the Buddha speaks about people of integrity in many, 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 many suttas. To prepare this talk, I read many of them, and there was one that I especially liked. The standard is the Siklavada Sutta, which is too long, and I've given talks on it, and I'm not even going to go there. But this one, okay, very briefly. A person endowed with these four qualities can be known as a person of integrity. This is the kind of person you want to have as a friend. Which four? There is the case where a person of integrity, when asked, doesn't reveal another person's bad points, to say nothing of one asked. Furthermore, when pressed with questions, he is the one who speaks of another person's bad point, not in full, not in detail. Then again, a person of integrity, when unasked, reveals another person's good points, to say nothing of one asked. Furthermore, when asked, when pressed with questions, he is the one who speaks of another good points in full and in detail, without omissions, without holding back. And then again, a person of integrity, when unasked, reveals his own bad points, to say nothing of when asked. Furthermore, when asked, when pressed with questions, he is one who speaks of his own bad points in full and in detail, without omissions, without holding backs. And then it goes on to good points, and he doesn't go into those. So I think all of this is working with self-identity and working with other people's feelings and having compassion. So that's the first factor, condition leading to stream entry. Listening to the Dhamma. I gave a talk on this the last year. It's one of the shortest suttas in the world. It was very appropriate. It's Anguttara Nikaya 5202. There are these five rewards in listening to the Dhamma. Which five? One hears what one has not heard before. One clarifies what one has heard before. One gets rid of doubt. One's views are made straight. One's mind grows serene. That's it. That's the sutta. So if you come to SIM or you go to SBMG or you go to Valley Streams, why are you going there? Are you going there to be entertained and then leave and that's that? Or are you really going to put this into practice? And if you are sincere about awakening, you are going to learn something from every single teacher and every person you meet if you listen. And especially when you come to listen to Dhamma talks, are you actually going to use this information to awaken? The third is appropriate attention. And this, Gil spends a lot of time on this one. It's really dependent origination. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything has cause and effect. Every single thing. You, the trees outside, the earth, everything. It didn't happen in a vacuum. Something happened and something else happened, and it continues and goes on. I think I told you during my retreat I was doing listening to a lot of podcasts by Sam Harris instead of Dharma Talks. Whoops. And one of them, which I found fascinating and has really, it's been very interesting, is on free will. He goes into dependent origination. If you don't know who Sam Harris is, he is a committed atheist. He's a scientist, as I mentioned, but he's a Buddhist practitioner, but he will never say that. But he goes on three-month retreats, and he absolutely believes mindfulness and meditation makes all the difference in the world. And that's why I want to listen to what he had to say, because he is coming from a very scientific background. So if you want to listen to something interesting, listen to his podcast and the people he interviews. In fact, Terry, I think, was telling me she read the book, Buddhism is True. Is that the name of it?
Why Buddhism is True.
Why Buddhism is True by Robin Wright?
Robert Wright.
Anyway, he interviewed him, and they had a great conversation, and very elucidating.
The Sam Harris person is the same person that wrote Waking Up?
Yes. Yes. And he's written, I think, about 7 or 8 books. So, yeah, this one happens to be good. Anyway, I got off a little bit, but Sam Harris goes into dependent origination. He says, yeah, absolutely, it makes sense. He said, the only thing is, there is no free will. And he goes out to prove it to the best of his ability. Here's where he divides. He comes away from Buddhist practice, because the Buddha said, there is free will. Where is there free will?
In the present.
That's right. This is it, right here, this moment. That's it. Everything else is causes and conditions leading up to this moment, but if we're awake, we can do something about it. We have a choice. Sam Harris says, no, we don't. And he goes into neuroscience. It's really, really interesting. I'm not going to go there because it's really beyond my mental capabilities, but I enjoyed hearing his reasoning. The other thing regarding appropriate attention, and I gave a Dharma talk on this, is asking the appropriate questions. Did anybody remember my Dharma talk on asking appropriate questions?
Yes.
Thank you. One person. I'm glad I spent a lot of time on that. Thank you, Boogie. So, asking appropriate questions is important because if you can clarify in your own mind what you need to do and ask about it, you're ahead of the game. If you're just muddled around, I don't know what I'm talking about, I don't know what I'm thinking about, I can't really put it into words, well, not too much help from anybody. So clarifying questions is really important. Okay, so characteristics of somebody who has achieved stream entry. Remember, they have eliminated the first three fetters of self-identity, doubt, and clinging to rites and rituals. Okay, so what would that be like? Self-identity. You know, this is difficult. It's very difficult when you think about it, not clinging to self-identity. Even in metta practice, we're supposed to start with ourselves. Because if we don't start with ourselves and we don't have kindness for ourselves, how can we have kindness for anybody else? And yet, here is this first fetter we're supposed to abandon is self-identity. Well, this is why it's difficult, and this is why this path can be difficult, but it also means that we start looking at the self-identity as a process rather than as an independent entity standing on its own. That's the difference. It's not there is no self, it's there is no permanent abiding self, that you are a process that's constantly changing as you're sitting here. Everything is changing. Of course you're here and you're listening, but you're changing and you're going to be different by the time you get home. Everything is. So not clinging to this is the way I am and this is the way it's got to be and this is the way you are and that's it. And if things don't line up like that, I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. So a Sotipanna starts seeing that, which means they're starting to see right view, the first of the Noble Eightfold Path. They're not clinging to a view. Not easy. Not easy at all. But when you start getting a taste of it, you can't go back. And I know many of you know exactly what I mean. You got a taste of it. Wish I didn't know this because this is hard, but, you know, it is the way life is. I think another thing about self-identity, and this is my own thought, and I've thought this for a while, and right view is actually understanding you will die. And how many times have you heard somebody say, if I die? All the time. And I think that's telling, if I die, like you've got a choice. You know, this whole dependent origination, eventually this body gives itself up. You will die. And I know I always appreciate when somebody, I'm speaking to someone and we're speaking about death or the death of a loved one, they say, when I die. I think, oh, they're on the road. You know, that's a first step in accepting death happens and calling it death, you know, instead of euphemisms to make it sound, you know, he transitioned, he passed away, you know, whatever. He died. You know, that's what happens. The second is ridding of doubt or uncertainty. The Orthodox teachings mean we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and we are fully committed that the Buddha was awakened, the Dharma is true, and the Sangha is our support. I agree with that, but I think I like putting it into more the Dharma is true. And when I ask myself that, yeah, because the Dharma is how life is. You know, that's what it comes down to. It is cause and effect. It's the way life is. There's no skipping anything. And when you start looking at it through that lens, you realize it's just talking about life. The Buddha was talking about life and how we live life and how life evolves. There's a interesting sutta when we finally wake up to this and we start seeing the truth of how life is. The Buddha said it's like a person who is blind and has not seen for a while, and then somebody gives him an oily, dirty cloth and said, "This is a white, clean cloth. Why don't you wear it?" And they go, "Thanks." And they put it on, and people are kind of revolted by this dirty cloth. And then by some miracle, this person gains their sight and sees what they've been doing and wearing, and they get rid of it immediately. They don't want to deal with that anymore. They've been tricked. The last is rites and rituals. So I think a lot of people think, well, that's easy. I don't believe in spells. And, you know, I don't go to magicians. And it's not as easy as it sounds. I think Gil did a really good job of explaining this, because even the five training precepts, which are the basis for ethical life in Buddhist practice, can become rites and rituals. If you are just doing them rote, "I am not going to do this. Oops, I can't do that. No, I'm not going to do that. I am not going to steal. I'm not going to take Terry's book when she's not looking. Nope, you know, that's not good." The point is, unless we know that we want to alleviate suffering for ourselves and others, we know it, and that's why we're doing it, it becomes a rite and ritual. So that's practice. Actually understanding, why am I doing this? Not just a verbatim, "I'll do this, 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 and this." The Buddha gave an example of a baby being born, and that baby has not experienced anything, is going to grow up. So it is actually practicing the precepts because it's not doing anything. And he said, that baby is not enlightened, because it hasn't had the experience of suffering and understanding suffering and attenuating suffering. So what about the death of a stream enter, Sotipanna? Well, he's not going to be born, he or she is not going to be born in lower than a human realm, not more than seven times. When I was reading some of the commentaries on this by teachers, people were saying, well, what about the death of a stream enter and they are in a coma? And, Thich Nhat Hanh has said, which I think is a beautiful sentiment, the last thought of this lifetime is the first thought in the next. It's a nice sentiment. Well, what if you're in a coma? Or what if you're on drugs that are alleviating pain? What happens then? Well, according to the teachings, because of your practice, because you're a stream enter, that surmounts any kind of drugs. Just the way you are surmounts that. When I was on retreat with Analio's retreat last year, we actually discussed this, and he says, and I have a great deal of respect for him, he said, even if you have Alzheimer's, you have incredible dementia, and you have been out of it for years, when you die, the instant you let go, you become clear. I'd like to think that's true. I don't know how he knows. I think he is an enlightened being, and maybe he's seen this, you know, in some way, but I thought that was very hopeful and helpful. All right, so I also, and maybe you want to, oh, we got plenty of time, and maybe you want to help with this. So I came up with my own list. Oh, wait a minute, I wanted to say, there was one analogy, and I also want to say one more thing about Sam Harris, too. One of his podcasts, he was talking about this topic. He talks it in very secular terms, but it was pretty much the same thing. And he was really talking about rites and rituals. And he said he made the vow that he will never lie again. He said it has caused too much suffering. And it was interesting for me because those of you who know about right speech and about lying, the Buddha attenuates it to a degree. You know, do you always tell the truth? Well, according to the Buddha, no. It depends on the time. It depends on your frame of mind, the person's frame of mind, who you are going to tell the truth to. I mean, there's a whole lot of circumstances. So Sam Harris says, I will never lie, ever. And he said he tells every person that he meets, and his wife knows this, and his colleagues know this, I will not lie, period. And he said it has made all the difference in the world. He feels he has alleviated suffering for himself and others because he's never saying anything to hurt anybody. He's telling the truth. You know, that's just one way of looking at it. So they say a Sotapatthana, stream enter, has seen, it's like the analogy of one teacher, I think Philip Moffat said this, it's like you're hiking and you want to climb a mountain and it's a long ways off, but you see the mountain out there and you know it's there and you know you got a lot of work to do to get to the top of it. You got to train, you have to have the right equipment, but you see it. And you know it's possible, and you go for it. That's what a Sotapatthana is. It is said that people who are entering the stream don't necessarily, they still might have a glass of wine. They might fib on occasion, but they know what they're doing. They understand what they have to do. They see, remember what I said about a teacher who understands where faults lie and where some improvement, you see that. And that's, you think about it, that's a huge step to actually see what you need to do. I mean, for, you know, I think the majority of mankind, we don't see what we need to do. It's somebody else, I can't help it, I've got this excuse or that excuse. Sotapatthana no longer has that, they see. Even if they're maybe not capable of doing everything that they should, right at that point, they're on the path. So, and it said a Sotapatthana instinctively avoids doing anything that is highly immoral. They just can't do it anymore. They just can't. They'll slip up. But, you know, stealing something, cheating on a spouse, it's not possible any longer. So I came up with kind of a list that brought all of these into account, and I'd love to hear your take on it as well, and something you think that needs to be added to it. So, oh, and then I'm going to go into something else in just a minute. So my list. Your views are not fixed. Boy, that alone, is that hard? I mean, I've got Trump supporters in my family, and I don't mean to get into politics, but I'm not, and, you know, I just didn't realize how fixed my views are till I start getting into a discussion with them. But I am doing better because I don't argue anymore. I listen a lot, but I can feel internally my views are fixed. So that's something I have to work on. So not having fixed views, I would think you're well on your way to actually be so malleable, so open to what somebody else is thinking. Abiding by the precepts comes naturally to you if you're a Sotapatthana. So you just wouldn't even consider breaking a precept. It just isn't possible anymore. Compassion arises easily. And I know this has happened for me and for many of you as practice starts. People have told me when I've done mentoring sessions, I just feel so bad when I see suffering and, you know, people actually crying, getting emotionally involved. And they will say, and I felt this too, and it's painful. I want to do something about this. But that's the path. You know, when you're awakened, what happens? Equanimity happens. You do what you can, but you're not going to suffer for it. You're just going to be with whatever's taking place. A person who is trying to be a Sotipanna, that condition is arising in you, and there's nothing to be done other than knowing that you are becoming a more humane person. Other sentient beings' concerns are yours, and you suffer for it. That's part of it. The people you spend time with elevate your mind. So think about it. Think about your friends and acquaintances and the kind of things that you enjoy discussing. You know, do you leave feeling, I don't know, awash with new ideas and creative ideas, or do you feel that that was a waste of time? You want to be with people who elevate you. This is, I think, a big one. Solitude no longer means loneliness. And I know that's true for a lot of you. You actually enjoy solitude. You enjoy those times alone. It no longer means, what am I going to do? I gotta get on the internet. I gotta get on the phone. I gotta call someone. I gotta eat. I gotta watch TV. I gotta do something. You know, instead, it's, I value this time that I've got for myself. Even if it's just sitting and watching a tree out in the backyard, you're fulfilled by it. Happiness arises for no apparent reason. I had this happen a lot on retreat. I actually wrote it down a number of times. I'm so happy. And it was just so wonderful. There was no conditions. It was just happiness arising. It just rises up. And then sometimes it goes away. And then it rises up again. And then it goes away. And then you start not taking any of it so seriously, because it's just constantly doing one or the other. And you just watch. I think this one's really important. Personality is not a criteria for being a stream enterer. And this is a hard one. You know, I think when we think in terms of people who we think are waking up, enlightened, we've always got this kind of, ooh, kind of misty feeling about them. You know, they're good, they're kind, they're wonderful, they're always together. Well, according to the Buddha and according to other teachers, that is not true. That is not always true. There's a great story, I think it's about Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he was a wonderful Thai master in, yeah, he was Thai. And he came to the U.S., I believe, Spirit Rock. And everybody there was very, very happy and, you know, trying to do whatever they could for him. And he was just growling at everybody, you know, and just mad and not saying too much. And they were going, what are we doing wrong? Why is he not in a good mood? And finally, one of the teachers spoke to him, and he said, oh, that. He goes, God, this personality of mine, what are you going to do? And he was Ayasanthicitta's first teacher, and she said, you know, that's the way it was. But you knew that he was definitely an elevated human being. But he just happened to have kind of a cantankerous personality. Anybody add to this list?
I you're talking about being around people that elevate you, I don't necessarily think those are the people that maybe make you feel more creative. Sometimes they can be people who have, you know, or come away with better ideas. They're often people that are impaired or have problems themselves. I think being open to people and listening to people, you gain so much in one form or another, and choosing to be with those people that are kind of the way I heard it from you was a little bit like, you know, it had a tinge of, and it may be the way I heard it, but it had a tinge of rank or something. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you choose to be around people that are more educated or more creative or people that get your creative juices flowing, I think you can be around people from all walks of life. And if you're open to them, I mean, those people can provide a lot in your life.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think that choosing to be around the right people doesn't mean choosing to be around people that elevate your intellect or your creativity or your stature in any way. It elevates the better parts of right speech and right action.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that, Laura.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Be hanging out with the, you know, people who are lying and stealing and raping.
Right.
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 All of your best friends.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't have anything to add to the list, but I want to go back to the personality thing. Mm-hmm. It's a little troubling to me. And I remember Ed S.B. Brown tells a story on himself that when he was first at Tassajara and got assigned to the kitchen, and he'd just been doing cleanup and he was able to maintain equanimity and peacefulness, but then he got assigned to be the cook and he suddenly found his anger, and which anybody who knows chefs understand. And he got a reputation for his explosive anger, and he talked to his teacher about it, and his teacher said to him, "You have absolute right to that anger. It is part of you. It is absolutely, you should embrace it, but maybe not so much out loud." because if we are to practice right speech, then if you give yourself total permission to call something just by personality, then you lose the other aspect, it seems to me. So I think, could you speak up?
I think you explained it perfectly. I think if you see that it's causing suffering, and because of the way you're responding, yeah, somebody who's a stream enter would see that happening. I think in Ajahn Buddhadasa, the example I gave, he was a curmudgeon. He had short, quick answers, and people thought that, I think, had an idyllic notion of how, you know, this enlightened master would be. And he didn't fit the bill. And so their views were distorted. Nobody ever said he was mean. He was just abrupt, you know, had requests and that kind of thing. So, but I agree with you. I think if, you know, an aspect of your personality is causing suffering for others, you definitely have to look at it. Yeah. Thanks, Margaret.
Yeah. I remember a similar comment from Pema Chodron when I was reading something of hers. This is when I was first reading stuff. And she says, you know, being a stream enterer does not mean that you're going to, that a whatever it was, it were various personality traits. They're not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change that aspect of you, and that it's not going to bring all sweetness and light.
Exactly.
The other comment would be relevant to what Laura and Renee said, which is that I think of it mostly about right speech. Once you are aware of harmful speech, and especially gossip, when you're around other people who are talking badly of others or gossiping and so forth, it's tempting to engage with it, mm-hmm. but really it sort of pulls you down and you know it.
Exactly.
You can't not know it anymore.
That's right.
So it's easier to spend less time with people when you go out feeling like, and it's not that you're not feeling more creative or more intellectually stimulated. You're feeling like this really didn't, I don't feel like
yeah.
it was, you go out feeling a little bit dirty somehow.
Yeah.
Or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thank you, both of you, for clarifying that, because I think you're both absolutely right. Miles, did you want to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Not out loud anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is different from what you've said, but what comes to my mind is being able to recognize and accept one's shadow. Or what psychology would call the shadow, and that is those parts of you that get perhaps evoked in a situation that do not serve your higher self or mm-hmm. anyone else's, and to be able to recognize that and accept it without going into judgment, but to take that as a way of kind of recalibrating and making a shift so that you behave perhaps differently, but it's also recognizing from the self-identity place that we all have the capacity for what would be considered shadow. We all have the capacity to do negative things, to have negative thoughts and so forth. When you can recognize that capacity and see when it gets provoked and be able to observe yourself in it, you're less likely to have it take mm-hmm. over mm-hmm. and control your behavior. So I don't know if that's covered or not, but that's what comes to my mind when I
hear it's a good reflection. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so I'm going to... Oh, I'm sorry. Who else? Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to make a suggestion to add to the list, something along the lines of recognizing moral karma in your own personal actions and behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
The Buddha said that it's beyond human comprehension, but maybe in one's own life you can see that things have happened to you because of something you did in the past. And making that kind of connection might be the sign of a...
Hard to do, but I think it's great if you can see that, and thank you. So, if you're a bodhisattva, if you're a sotapanna, do you talk about it? Do you ever talk about it? Let's say you guys are all sotapannas. You're all on the path. Do you talk to anybody else about it?
No.
I'm seeing no.
No.
Not about how great you are.
Is
that self-identity?
Yeah, Boogie.
Yeah, I don't think they do. Just all the great names and things like that, you don't really hear them talking about. Maybe generally after somebody passes away, sometimes people will acknowledge that they were an arahant or something like that, but it seems to me they don't say what stage they're at. Attainments, yeah. They don't talk about their attainments.
The only place where I found that rule does not apply was, they said, if it will benefit somebody to know. So, you know, say you're a sotapanna, you know it, a teacher, somebody's recognized you, you can tell, and somebody else is suffering, and they're kind of midway in the path, and you want to encourage them that you will get over this, and here's what will happen when you get over this. It would be appropriate. But if you want to go and announce you're a sotapanna, well, that's impossible, because the very first thing you drop is self-identity. So you're not. You know, as soon as that's coming up, oh, I've got to tell the world where I'm at, you're not. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Also, it's according to the classic teachings, it's very difficult for ordinary people to tell if somebody's a Sotipanna. And there's a story in the Pali Canon about Sariputta giving, mentoring a young monk and, you know, giving him advice and doing this and you need to do that. And the monk was sitting there very quietly nodding his head. And the Buddha called him away and said, you don't have to do that. He's a Sotipanna. He knows all that. Sariputta, who was enlightened himself, didn't recognize it. So I think the best thing to do is treat everybody like they're potential Sotipannas, that they're doing the best they can. You encourage them and be that person of integrity. Hopefully that's what we can all do for everybody. And that's the end of my talk. So does anybody have any final comments or questions? Not that I can answer any, but if you do. Yeah, Ginger? Jim, and then you. Yeah, Ginger.
Sometimes I don't know how I appear to someone else, if we were talking about reflection, until somebody points it out or I see it. It's hard sometimes to see yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, and then there's habits. I think Dennis, said last week, it takes 40 days to break a habit. So about change and reflections, I notice myself changing, but going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it takes a lot of effort.
Yeah, well, that's life, you know, and I think every one of us would say exactly the same thing. It's a lot of effort. But we also don't have a choice. You know, we just have to keep going on. There's no going back. Yeah. Jim?
You've talked about 100 things tonight.
Yeah.
And it's much more complicated for me than any kind of science or engineering. So I'm going to ask you, what if we carry away one thing that's important to you, what would it be? Okay?
Yeah, thanks for that.
for me, self-identity is important. I got that. And I'd like to come to your one-day retreat if that's going to be the topic.
That is going to be the topic. I think for me, what has been important and what is emphasized in general through this is right view. I think that's the crux of our practice. Clinging to views about ourselves and clinging to views about others and about everything and acting like that's true, that we really know what's going on. And I think the whole Sotipanna thing is understanding that I have to question everything about myself and everything I believe to be true and investigate just like a scientist. You know, and I've given talks on right view, and I think the easiest definition is not clinging to any view at all. And it's probably the hardest thing in the world to do as well. All right, it is 9:01. We'll do a final dedication of merit. So may all of us here on this path, may we all keep going towards the mountain. It's going to be difficult at times. But may we keep striving, may we keep seeing the vision ahead, because our freedom is tied up to the freedom of all living beings. And may our practice tonight, may our Dhamma practice in daily life be given freely to every sentient being, and may all beings, we here in this room and all beings everywhere, may we all eventually be completely freed from suffering. So thank you all for coming.